The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and this week we are celebrating gesture, from the double tap that's become universal on our smartphones to the future of physicality in computer games. This week, it's all about the user interface. That's all coming up on this week's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, before we get stuck into gesture, we couldn't ignore this week's big tech story, the palaver with the new iPhone Maps. And joining me in the studio now to talk through what on earth, literally, get it? Yes. What on earth happened is The Guardian's telecoms correspondent, Juliet Garside. Thank you for coming in.
Hello.
And so, the big story this week, it's about the maps that have been, that have been transformed away from Google Maps into Apple's own Maps application. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, so as you say, Google used to provide the maps, that the Maps app that was preloaded onto previous versions of Apple's phone software. And for a reason that's never been fully explained to consumers, Apple has replaced its own map, developed in-house and in collaboration with some other companies like TomTom, the sat-nav people, and is now using that as a default app. And Google hasn't created a standalone apps map for iPhones, so you can't go and download one either. So people are genuinely kind of stuck now.
So if they, if they have an iPhone and they upgrade their operating system, which is often something that happens automatically through iTunes or you know, it sort of automatically happens, doesn't it? They are now stuck with this system.
Yes, correct. So everyone who already had an iPhone or who's buying one today, will have Apple Maps. And people were prompted yesterday who had previous iPhones to the iPhone 5 to download iOS 6, so to switch to the new system. I actually considered not doing that because within minutes of iOS 6 being released in the States, people were complaining about the mapping software. And I use mine all the time. I use it when I'm driving. I use it when I'm trying to get around town. I need it to work.
Okay, so the problem really is the maps. So tell me a little bit about the feedback. I've seen it on Twitter, and I've heard from people who were beta testing before that it basically drops things like Nottingham off the map. Tell me a little bit about some of the problems that we've encountered.
You can make it sound quite comical because you know, they've shrunk the Sears Tower. They put a pin on the satellite image of another building that was much smaller than the Sears Tower in Chicago. And it seems to be planting trees everywhere, which is very green of them. But Helsinki railway station, the bit where you'd normally see railway tracks on a map, has been coloured in green and turned into a park. Paddington and Tokyo railway stations, two of the biggest rail terminals in the world, are unfindable through search. And in fact, if you do find Paddington Station on the map, it is there. If you kind of scan across to find it, you'll see that Paddington Basin, which is the canal it sits next to, has also been transformed into a park and coloured in green. So there's clearly a lot of gremlins in the software. Some of it's kind of excusable, like because Apple hasn't got years of search experience, it's understandable that maybe if you don't type in London Paddington, which is what they call it, you won't find it. And those things are meant to improve with time. But other things like spelling city names wrong is quite inexcusable. So in the UK, we've had Doncaster transformed to Duncaster, D-U-N.
That is how it's pronounced, to be fair. Yeah. And we don't need to go into the whole Leicester Square debacle, right?
Yeah. Westminster is now Westminster. So some of these glitches were in the beta version, have been known about for months, and Apple's had quite a lot of time to fix them. And the question is, if they knew there were these kind of gremlins, why did they put maps as the lead feature of the iPhone 5? It was the new feature that they really wanted to shout about. They showed us the new aerial view technology. When you go onto the iOS 6 website, it's the first app that they talk about. And they prided themselves on the graphic design, the cartography, as they called it. So given that this is still really a beta software piece with a lot of glitches, why have they put so much emphasis on it?
And why do you think that is? Is it because the rest of the software hasn't advanced in a particular way? Or is it because they're suddenly, because they know that people would focus on the fact that it was an Apple product as opposed to the Google system that was being used before? Do you think they were essentially trying to cut off the pass of any kind of arguments and any kind of criticism in that way?
If you promote something, you draw attention to it. So I'm not sure that you would want to do that with a product that wasn't fit for purpose. They sort of did it last year with Siri, which I thought worked pretty well in terms of voice recognition, but in the UK hadn't been hooked up to the weather and the directory services, so it couldn't really provide a full service. They could have just restricted that feature to the US, but instead they promoted it as the major new wow feature of the iPhone 4S. I was speaking to a phones analyst last week, the night of the iPhone 5 launch, who was saying that he thinks that a change under Tim Cook is that Apple may have lost its obsession with the product and transferred its obsession to management, money-making. I mean, it's a cynical view, and I don't think it's entirely fair, but there has not been enough focus on this product. Apple, to be fair, have released a statement today saying that they appreciate the feedback and Maps is a cloud-based solution. I'm just reading from it here. And the more people use it, the better it will get. So, yeah, search results will be improved. And clearly, if people pick out misspellings, they can correct that. But at the same time, we don't really know why it's been substituted for Google Maps. And I don't write about tech all the time. I write about telephones. But I find when I write about companies like Apple and Google, it's a bit like Kremlinology. These companies don't communicate very well with journalists. Maybe it's a natural reaction to having thousands of bloggers covering them. But at the moment, they're in danger of being seen to put their own commercial interests before those of consumers.
And that is a shift, a real shift from how Apple has been viewed in the past.
Yes. Very consumer focused in the past. And Google as well, with its don't do evil message, which we'll know about.
Yes.
It's not just Apple that's at fault here. I think Google did consumers a big disservice by not giving certain features that it had given to Google Maps on Android to iPhone users with the 4S. It didn't have turn-by-turn navigation. And I think that's really dangerous for a lot of drivers. I'm afraid I did use my Google Maps on my iPhone as a navigation tool because it's still a bit safer than a paper map. But having to move things across the screen while you're driving is not great. And so withholding services like that, I think there is a bit of an ethical issue.
Thanks, Juliet. And you can see more on this story across The Guardian, including a slideshow of other cuckoo maps. guardian.co.uk/technology. Recently, London was the host of the Touch Gesture Motion Conference, the place where people who decide how we interact with our technologies meet to share ideas and innovations, and perhaps touch one another. I don't know, I'm not going to go down that route. Charles Arthur, however, was there during the conference, and he met with Asaf Gad from Point Grab, who gave us the lowdown on the role of the hand on controlling the machines.
Welcome, Asaf. First of all, tell us, what is it that Point Grab is trying to do? You have a sort of a system which works on Windows 8, which runs on the camera. But what is the solution that you're trying to provide here?
The main idea behind our solution, other than technology, is actually adding another dimension to user experience. Just like touch added a new kind of experience to cell phones, we believe that hand gesture can bring this new dimension of interaction for many other devices like TVs, computers and tablets.
So, I mean, a lot of computers, for example, will already be fitted with a webcam fitted into the lid of a laptop. And same for a number of desktops. They'll have webcams. People will have those available. So it's able to see when you move your hand to the side or front and back, and you're able to tie gestures and so on and actual actions on the screen to those. Do you think that there's a demand to do that when people have a keyboard, when they have a mouse or a trackpad right in front of them?
So first of all, we are not here to replace any of the existing methods of interaction. Not the keyboard, not the mouse, and not even the touchscreen. What we believe is, first of all, is actually adding this dimension. For example, for gaming is the most intuitive example that we can provide. Think about it, playing Angry Birds instead of on a 2D flat screen, playing it from front in the front view, just like in the 3D world, just like the world that we are living in. So we see ourselves as a complementary user interaction for these devices and not replacing them. So first of all, the most basic one is interact with the device from a distance. It's very self-explanatory with TVs, but also with computers that, you know, the screen are getting bigger, the demands for it as a media center at home. It's something that we hear more often from our users and customers. And instead of using just another remote control and then getting messed with all these devices around the house, you just need to wave to your computer or TV and control. Very simple.
It sounds a bit like the Kinect, but obviously it isn't the Kinect. You say that the difference is that it's a 2D camera only.
Yes, of course. I think the Kinect was the pioneer of this kind of interaction, mainly for gaming and maybe exercising. What the Kinect does, which is different from us, is two things. First of all, the technology is based on a 3D camera, which is a piece of hardware that need to be integrated into devices, unlike our solution that is based on a 2D camera. And just as you said, any webcam that is already integrated for today for TVs as well, but also for computers, laptops, cell phones, tablets, it's already there. All you need is just to install the software and have it on your device. The second thing is that we are focusing on the hand. We are not focusing on a full body control recognition, unlike the Kinect. So it allows us to have more resolution about simple and smaller gestures that are not tiring. So you can lay back, sit in front of the TV, and just with your finger and your hand, raise the volume, change channels very easily without any hassle.
So you're looking to replace the remote control, perhaps?
We believe that the remote control is like almost 100 years that it is available there.
It feels
that way. And no one, the same way, it's just like the mouse. No one actually managed to replace the mouse, not even the touch screens on the PCs. We see ourselves as a complementary. So it will, the remote control maybe will be there for people that are getting used to it. But we believe that with the years and that the technology is there, but people will get used and change their behaviors with the new technology. And maybe, I don't know, 100 years from now, no one will remember the remote control.
So you're talking about TV. Are there companies which are using your gesture-based systems out there on the market now?
Yes, we have a solution that was released at the beginning of the year on a million of devices. We are not allowed to expose the name of the brand, but this is probably one of the most famous solution in the market.
A company people would have heard of?
Yes, of course.
Okay. And which operating systems does your product run on?
So as you mentioned, we run on Windows 8, which is a great platform for gestures. We run off Linux and Android as well.
What sort of potential do you see for other devices? I mean, smartphones, the screen is a bit small for gestures. TV sets seem like an ideal sort of size. Laptops are maybe in between. Where do you see the potential for gesture-based control?
So it is a combination of three things. The bigger the screen is, the bigger the distance from the screen for interaction is relevant. And of course, as many people as are using this screen, this will make our solution more attractive. The best thing to think about it is the digital signage area. More and more places are equipped today with big screens that allows people to interact with them. We saw many people in videos that do not like to touch with these kind of things because of, you know, kind of the germs and things, and these screens are also get, you know, dirty with the time, and people really see this as a disgusting thing to touch these devices, and we believe that the gesture is a perfect solution for them. If you are looking ahead, you know, like a few years from now, think about things like window shopping that people are talking about it mainly, or see it mainly in movies. You can walk on the street, stop across a store that you like, and just wave with your hand and interact. Instead of just see dolls with some clothes on it, you can interact with a screen and see the clothes that you want, and maybe even purchase through this window. And that's it. This is a great solution that looks very far away, but the technology is there. It's just a matter of having it ready.
So we've caught you on your way to a conference about touch and gesture. In the past few years, how has that whole field changed? I mean, what's actually brought it on? Has it been increased computing power? Has it been better algorithms, better cameras? What's driven it?
First of all, the availability of cameras. Cameras is everywhere. On every device, you can see the camera. The second thing is that if the main problem was that the technology wasn't there. The performance, the environment was very tricky for this kind of solution. I think that today the technology is mature enough and allows people to actually use it and not just standing in a specific lighting condition or in a specific room. It can actually work on almost every environment.
How much better have the cameras got? Because you say the cameras are all there. Front cameras are getting better on phones and obviously
they're more
available.
There is a demand today for HD cameras. So maybe not for phones, because phones, there are two cameras and then there is a cost issue. But on laptops, HD camera already there. But by the way, our solution requires just a VGA, simple camera, no more than that. But of course, the better the camera is, the better performance and the better accuracy of the solution is.
Are there any great changes that you see coming? I mean, as I say, you've got this conference coming up. What sort of things are you expecting to see being presented there?
I think the main thing is the change in mind. If up until now people mostly think that we can define a new way to interact with a device, and we will set a fixed predefined gesture for each device, we believe that today we need to add more flexibility and more dynamic interface to allow people to actually define the way that they want to interact with the device. And gesture is a great way to do that, because there are unlimited number of gestures that we can support, any pose of the hand or even two hands, and anyone can define it by himself and maybe even share a new gesture with each other. And this is the way that I think that this technology will be embraced by the people.
So the whole Minority Report thing, where, you know, Tom Cruise is controlling everything and wishing things away and all that sort of stuff, is all coming.
Yeah, it's even cooler than Minority Report, because if you remember, in Minority Report, Tom Cruise need to have things on, like gloves on his hands. So the real thing, the technology allows you to do it with bare hands, so you don't need anything. So it will be even cooler than that.
That's great to hear. Asif Gad from Point Grab, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, these technologies aren't just for business applications. Sure, we're probably most familiar with them on our smartphones, but artists and other creatives are really pushing the envelope when it comes to how it is that we interact with our machines. I spoke with Evan Grant, the founder of the arts collective Seeper, about some of his motion interactions and how projects like his advance the commercial side.
I think the thing for us that kind of stood out was that all of the technology that we're using is very much learned technology. So, you know, if you think about a computer, you've got effectively a glorified typewriter in the form of a keyboard, and the mouse, you know, and the screen, which are both things that don't really have parallels in nature. And one of the things we started thinking about was, you know, how can we make something that's much more intuitive? How can we create something that's very instinctive to human behavior? And we found that when you're able to do that, not only is it more accessible to people, but it is more rewarding when people interact in that way.
What was your starting point? Was it, was it physical movement? Was it sound? Was it just watching, I don't know, monkeys playing with a ball? What was your starting point?
I mean, my background is I come from sort of, you know, lighting design, lots of different things. But I think in terms of this journey into more intuitive interaction, the first thing was really very much about touch. And we started playing around with kind of before multi-touch mobiles and all that kind of stuff, we started playing around with building our own sort of multi-touch surface computers, you know, and playing around with, interacting with fingers just purely onto a display. And that really got us thinking about, you know, how we could extend this language of gestures and how we could create much more interesting interactions.
Now, it's interesting because touch is considered something different from gesture. If you look at, if you look at hardline interaction conferences, they're often in multiple tracks. Can you tell me why?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would personally disagree with separating them. I think any kind of touch is very much gestural. And if you think about the things that are commonplace now, for example, you know, pinching to zoom or double tapping to zoom in and out, those are gestures, and those are gestures that are touch based. And actually, the implementation of gestures in touch is at the moment the most widespread. I think the reason it perhaps gets separated is because a lot of people assume when you talk about gestures that it's about kind of air-based interaction, if you like. I mean, a lot of people talk about air touch, which is a kind of ridiculous term, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I can see what people mean by that. But I wouldn't separate them at all. I think, gesture is a human behavior. And I think it's irrelevant, really, what the technology is. It's more about how we can extend a universal language of gestures, to move us forward.
The idea of adaptive gesture is very interesting, especially when you consider back in the old days. Well, I say the old days, but say, the time of the Palm Pilot. You had to, the language that you used to input anything into that using your stylus was very specific gestures, very specific language.
Sure.
You had to learn that and you couldn't really veer from the path. How has technology evolved, though, that allows for personalization? Is it possible for an individual to hack through some of these gestural interfaces in order to create something that works for them, where somebody would be activating a system, the same system, but using completely different gestures?
I mean, it is. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily that accessible to end sort of consumers, if you like, at the moment, but certainly the ability to adapt, hack, program software to respond to gesture is getting way more accessible. And I think if anything, it should, that should increase. Hopefully it will get easier and easier. I think that the problem with any of these kind of emerging technologies is that there's always a period of kind of resistance while the paradigm sort of shifts, and often where a generation kind of hands the baton over, if you like. And I think we're about to hit a huge wave where gesture's really going to evolve way beyond what we're seeing at the moment.
That was Evan Grant from Seeper. And as Evan alluded, it was actually the computer games industry that's been at the forefront of gesture technology. So joining me in the studio now is Lyndon Vongsathorn from game developer Hide and Seek. But first, down the line, is The Guardian's games correspondent, Keith Stewart. Welcome, Keith.
Hello, Alex. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad that you could join us. Keith, you are our resident games expert. Tell me a little bit about the history of gesture in games, because it's interesting. Gesture seems to have been propelled into the public consciousness through games.
Yeah. I mean, technically, I guess you could say that gesture has been around since the start of games. I mean, not only joysticks on arcade machines, but also lots of early arcade machines in the 80s used things like trackballs, which were much more kind of had much more haptic complexity, I guess, than joystick games.
So hold on a second. Haptic complexity.
Haptics, obviously, haptics means touch, and when you're using a joypad, it's very kind of digital. When you're using a joystick, and especially in the early days, it was very much switches clicking on and off. Whereas In the early 80s, you've got games like Marble Madness, which use these trackball controllers, which give you much more sensitivity, much more analog sensitivity, and give you much more of a sense of interacting on a haptic, on a touch level.
But haptic as well, from what I understand, isn't haptic also feedback?
Yeah, I mean, and that came in as well in the early 80s. So you got lots of controllers, especially flight controllers, which started giving you that kind of haptic resistance as well. But in the they were all quite basic. But in a sense, you got this idea of game designers trying to interact with players on another level apart from just audio visual. I think the big breakthrough, although a lot of people think of the Nintendo Wii's Wiimote as being the first big kind of gesture control thing in home gaming, Sony released the iToy several years before, which was a little camera that went above your PlayStation 2, and you could play kind of gesture games on that.
SingStar, don't forget.
Exactly, yeah. And so, I mean, Sony's lab in London made some really kind of profound advances in gesture control with what was essentially a very kind of low-resolution camera that sat in front of your television. And it really introduced a new family audience, in a way, to games. Several years before Wii came out, but when Wii came out with its Wiimote, that really kind of exploded. Nintendo really knew how to market this device to get people playing, and they advertised it really well, so they got lots of people playing bowling games and tennis games on the TV. And that sort of advanced things quite a lot. And then after that, we had Microsoft and Sony responding to it, thinking, oh, no, we've got to up our game here. Microsoft released the Kinect. Sony released the PlayStation Move, which was another gesture control joystick, whereas the Kinect, again, was a camera system where it would pick up your body movements. And that sold around 12 to 15 million units. But the problem with it is now no one uses it anymore. The developers have more or less abandoned the technology in a lot of key ways.
Now, I'm interested by this idea that gesture seems to just simply be any kind of human-computer interface. Is that what you're suggesting?
I mean, I see it as any game which seeks to do anything more profound with the player than simply getting them to use a digital joypad. I think what things like Kinect and Move and the Wiimote have brought in is this idea of your physical presence and your physical presence interacting with the game. So it's not just about hand-eye coordination; it's about whole-body control. But this, as I said, this whole sense of a more kind of analog relationship with games has been around since the trackball joystick, although that's a very, very simple gesture interface. I'd still say that counted.
Now, bringing the physical into games is very much what our studio guest, Lyndon Vongsathorn, does at Hide and Seek. Welcome, Lyndon, to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Lyndon, tell me a little bit about Hide and Seek and what it is that as a games developer, as a games company, you seek to do.
Hilarious.
So Hide and Seek is obviously a game design company, but we work really hard to create games for people and new types of play that are specifically aimed at like a type of person and a type of place. So we're not doing sort of video games so much as, what game might a person play at a bus stop while they're waiting for the bus, or, in a gallery or a museum, what can a person do that's playful.
So this is not, these aren't first-person shooters.
No.
Though there are adaptations, interestingly enough, with sort of first-person shooters that people are playing with in these types of game environments, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And so we edge towards pervasive games, which is sort of a common way that the first-person shooters appear in a sort of city-wide environment. We aim to use technology more to support that kind of play than to create play that's all about the technology.
So tell me a little bit about how you use gesture, or in what way you would incorporate gesture into a game that you would design.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the really interesting thing for me about things like the Kinect and to an extent the Wii is that oftentimes you think about gesture in the same way as you would think about a controller, where there's a set of movements that you do that the TV or the game console responds to. So in order to throw the ball, you have to make a throwing movement. But the interesting thing about them is that that's not all it's confined to, because there isn't just a binary, did you do the movement or didn't you? You know, things like the Kinect can watch everything you're doing and understand not just a sort of binary, did you or didn't you, but the quality in which someone's doing that movement. So I think the really interesting thing about it is that you can design things to be much, in a way, much more human, because you can be responding not just to something that you're expecting the person to do, but how they're doing it and how an individual will sort of express a particular movement.
And of course, this is relevant to different environments. I know that you've done a piece of research at Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK that was called, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kinect in the Dark. So, you know, that's the darkness is another context in which we interact, in which we potentially play. How do people, what are gesture controls that can be used in those types of contexts?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting actually designing for the Kinect in the Dark, because as soon as you say that or tell people you're going to be interacting in the dark, everyone gets a little like, ooh, you know, and nervous about it. But when you put them in that situation past those nerves, people become much more, they lose a lot of the nervousness and being like the self-awareness of it, and they just sort of get really into things. So in the Kinect in the Dark project, we designed something that was trying to elicit smooth movement and slow movement rather than just here and then there, and a very connected experience. And we saw that like putting people in the dark and having them do this experience where they listened to music and headphones and sort of knew where to put their hands based on music they were hearing rather than anything they were looking at, they ended up moving very slowly and really getting into it and creating sort of narratives in their heads about what they were doing rather than just sort of saying, oh yeah, the computer wants me to go here and do this move. And they really stopped responding to what they thought the computer wanted and just started moving without really thinking about that.
Keith, this kind of thing is fascinating from a sort of a computer-based game design point of view. But one thing that Lyndon said there that's kind of intrigued me is the controllers that we're using have a kind of language, don't they? They force us in some ways to perform what it is that the game wants to do. There's a human computer interaction element to the game designer as well. So how would something like the Kinect, or how has something like the iToy even changed the expectations of the player to what it is that they are to play and how it is that they are to advance through the game narrative?
Yes, I think there has been a failure of imagination in the games industry, because they are not exploring the possibilities of players being able to use their bodies and use the analog nature of movement and to create interesting games. I think the most interesting and the most fundamentally interesting use I've seen of Kinect has been Double Fine's game Happy Action Theater, which is just a series of mini challenges. And they're not really challenges, they're just kind of games for children. For example, you'll be in a room full of virtual balloons and the camera will show you on screen surrounded by these virtual balloons, and all you have to do is go around your living room stomping on these balloons, and on screen it will show them popping. They're very simple, they're not even games, but what they're doing is exploring this whole idea of you reacting physically with a virtual world and using your body as a tool. And there's a kind of real sense of joy about the game, which almost every other game has failed to achieve.
How have you, Lyndon, taken the things that Keith is talking about and imported them? Can you give me an example of one of the designs that features a gestural interaction?
I did just finish making a game called Searchlight, where the goal is to pick up blocks that are sort of in a square space in the real world, but there's a projector and a Kinect set up sort of looking down on it, and there's a searchlight, so a beam of light that's projected down onto the space over the block that they're supposed to be picking up. And so when they're in the light, they have to freeze. And then once the light passes over them, they can start moving again. So it's a very real world game that involves body movement and that sort of that question of when am I freezing and when am I moving and how do I balance those two things.
Keith, I can totally imagine that in some of the stealth games that are very popular in traditional computer games.
Yeah, definitely. And I do wonder if we're going to see more. I know it's always a bit of a misnomer to rely on technology when it comes to imagination, but I wonder if in the next generation of consoles we're going to get cameras with much greater resolution, the ability to track skeletal positions with much greater clarity. I think we may see more interesting ideas like that. I speak a lot to Andrew Oliver, who's one of the founders of Blitz Games Studios up in Leamington, and he's an expert in gestural recognition and 3D. And he says that we're going to reach a stage with games that not only track very minute physical gestures, but can also track facial expressions. So we're going to get adventure games which learn to read human body language, learn to read facial tics, and our own emotions on our own slight physical gestures will play a part.
Keith Stewart and Lyndon Vongsathorn, thank you both very much. That's it for our gesture special. There's much more to explore. And if you have a story of your own, do let us know at techweekly@guardian.co.uk. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer of Tech Weekly is Jason Phipps. We are back next Tuesday. See you then.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.